Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and what Hallmark holiday is just ahead? Valentine's Day. Yes, I'm a sucker for love, and every now and then, the Book Report needs to celebrate a man, a woman, a relationship, and great gushy books about love. But fear not, as your literary guide, we'll be previewing novels worthy of your heart and your head. I've been prowling lists about love and great literature, so take heart. Let's begin as we turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
In a Jane Austen education, Austen scholar William Dersowitz turns to the author's novel to reveal the remarkable life lessons hidden within. With humor and candor, Dersowitz employs his own experiences to demonstrate the enduring power of Austen's teaching. Progressing from his days as an immature student to a happily married man, A Jane Austen Education is the story of one man's discovery of the world outside himself. A self-styled intellectual rebel dedicated to writers such as James Joyce and Joseph Conrad, Dersowitz never thought Austen's novels would have anything to offer him. But when he was assigned to read Emma as a graduate student at Columbia, something extraordinary happened. Austen's devotion to the everyday and her belief in the value of ordinary lives ignited something in the author. He began viewing the world through Austen's eyes and treating those around him as generously as Austen treated her characters. Along the way, Dersowitz was amazed to discover that the people in his life developed the depth and richness of literary characters, that his own life has suddenly acquired all the fascination of a novel. His real education had finally begun. A Jane Austen Education is a testament to the transformative power of literature and a celebration of Austen's mastery. Sean Pratt narrates.
My best friend, who knew me better than I knew myself, once introduced me to a friend of hers named Honor. Just as I was gearing up to reel off all the stupid puns I could think of, Your Honor, honor to meet you, and so forth, my friend caught the smirk spreading across my face and cut me off before I could make an idiot of myself. Billy, she explained with the weary patience with which you might address a difficult child, she's already heard them all. Basically, I had no insight into myself or anyone else. My romantic life, not surprisingly, had never been particularly happy. I was stuck at the time in a relationship that should have ended long before. We had jumped each other one night the previous summer, and though we'd been together for over a year, we had little in common and had never much progressed beyond the sex. She was gorgeous, bisexual, impulsive, experienced, with a look that knew things, and a laugh that didn't give a damn. We would go to bed, and then we would go dancing. And then we would go to bed again. But as for anything like real intimacy, I just couldn't manage it. I'd had girlfriends before, including ones I'd even thought I'd loved, but things had always ended badly. Fights, sulks, head games, tears. Eventually, good riddance. At least this time we didn't fight. We didn't talk, either. Not about anything real. Not about what was going on with us or what we might have been feeling. Instead, I'd hold forth as usual, even think I was doing her a favor in the process. I was a graduate student at Columbia, after all, and she had barely scraped through college. I was going to do something important with my life, and she was marking time as a waitress, a job that struck me as depressingly unambitious, while she tried to figure out her next move. In short, I didn't respect her enough to imagine that she might have anything to say to me that was worth listening to. I knew it wasn't a real relationship, but I kept telling myself that this was what I'd always wanted. A steady supply of sex with no strings attached. A teenage boy's idea of paradise. Except I wasn't a teenage boy anymore. Still, I thought, and this is how numb I was by then, well, so maybe I never will find that one person to love. So what? I knew deep down that the idea of doing without love for the rest of my life was completely absurd. That it was a sign of grave emotional peril that it could even occur to me. But I managed to keep the lid on my denial. Besides, I thought, as soon as you fell in love, people started expecting you to get married. And if there was one thing I knew, it was that I was never going to get married. My second year in graduate school, I signed up for a class called Studies in the Novel, less because I knew anything about it than because it sounded like a good fit. Our first two books were Madame Bovary, the novel that raised the art of fiction to a new level of cultural esteem, and The Ambassadors, Henry James's most honored masterpiece. So far, my need to study prestigious literature was being satisfied. Then came Emma. I'd heard some scattered talk over the years about its supposed greatness. One of the best novels in the language. More complex than anything in Joyce or Proust. But at first, my prejudices against Jane Austen were only confirmed. Everything was so unbearably banal. The story seemed to consist of nothing more than a lot of chit-chat among a bunch of commonplace characters in a country village. No grand events, no great issues, and, inexplicably for a writer of romance novels, not even any passion. Emma, it turned out, was Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich, who lived with her feeble, foolish old father on their family estate of Hartfield. Her life was impossibly narrow. Her mother had died when she was a baby. Her sister, Isabella, lived in London. And the governess who had raised her had just gotten married.
That was A Jane Austen Education by William Dershowitz. It's not the shoes, the scarves, or the lipstick that gives French women their allure. It's this. They don't expect men to understand them. They don't care about being liked or being like anyone else. They generally reject notions of packaged beauty. They accept the passage of time, celebrate the immediacy of pleasure, like to break rules, embrace ambiguity and imperfection, and prefer having a life to making a living. In her liberating book, What French Women Know About Love, Sex, and Other Matters of the Heart and Mind, Deborah Olivier goes beyond familiar stereotypes about French women, challenging notions about sex, love, marriage, motherhood, raising children, seduction, and flirtation. Peppered with anecdotes and filled with provocative thinking from French sexperts, the book presents a refreshing counterpoint to the love dogma of our times and offers realistic, life-affirming alternatives from the land that knows how to love. The author narrates.
No wonder we perceive the French woman as slightly wicked. Her passions are our provocations. We love her and we hate her because she seems to be everything that we're not. And because her way of being contradicts our cultural judgments and moral prejudices about love and sex. Plus, we're sure that she's got secrets. It seems she grew up steeped in sensuality while we were raised on canned heat. She certainly seems to know more about giving and receiving pleasure, which means that she's probably having more guilt-free sex than we are, and eating a lot more pastry, too. Like many Americans, I first traveled to France as a student backpacker. A few years later, I returned, enrolled myself in the Sorbonne, and moved into a converted broom closet in the posh but gloomy 16th arrondissement with a roommate named Solange. Solange was from Alsace. She was pale with straw-colored hair and reminded me of a garden elf. Despite this cherubic quality, she had a severity about her that evoked the rustic plains of her ancestral northern Europe. At least, that's how I perceived her penchant for frugality. She ate cheese to the rind, then dried it and grated it into her soup. Similar rituals were performed with dried, half-eaten baguettes. She was reserved, rarely gesticulated, and had three articles of clothing that she wore over and over again with only tiny adjustments to each look. In short, though Solange was no va-va-voom French girl, she did, despite her curiosities, have a certain undeniable charm and sex appeal. And I recall thinking that if she were a typical French girl, I'd have to adjust my cultural assumptions. I was already aware that the proverbial je ne sais quoi we Anglo-Saxons associate with French women did not have as much to do with surface detail as one might surmise. Yes, we know the Normans conquered the Anglo-Saxons centuries ago and nobody speaks like Beowulf anymore. I use the term Anglo-Saxon or Anglo as a multipurpose generic for American and British flavored cultures and for those raised on similar soil. To linguistic purists bothered by this liberty, mea culpa. During my séjour at the Sorbonne, I read many nouveaux romans, wore many scarves, and through my daily encounters with the natives, nurtured my own vigorous love-hate relationship with the French. A thick, delicious year passed, and upon my return to California, I assumed that my French days were over. They were not. Years later, I met a man working on a film in Los Angeles. I immediately knew that he was French because he was eating a hamburger with a fork. We courted, and I moved back to France again, where I married, had two children, and continued to study the local flora and fauna up close. This time, I lived in the northeastern fringe of the city's right bank, in the 19th arrondissement, a raggedy but rapidly gentrifying working-class swatch of northeastern Paris that I call People's Paris, for the sheer density of humanity packed into it from every corner of the world. A Parisian friend of mine once sniffed, "I need a passport to enter your neighborhood." At the time, his incurable snobism deeply impressed me. It's certainly a reminder that if France is the Eiffel Tower, it's also the Tower of Babel, and that goes for everything beyond the dense supernova of the city's capital as well. Be that as it may, when I first moved to the 19th, you couldn't find it on the maps of many guidebooks. It seemed as if their guidebook writers had laid a cookie cutter on the center of Paris, trimmed off the edges, and discarded them. Only a few landmarks scattered in these northern fringes were mentioned. The Père Lachaise Cemetery, Montmartre. Otherwise, the only real Paris that seemed to exist to purveyors of all things French was its center, namely, the left bank. I bring this up to make a point, which is this. Most of the enduring stereotypes we nurture about French women are exported from this center, where so many cultural scribes and tourists stake their claim. It's through the prism of this gilded old hub in arrondissements nestled around the Seine that we find our most enduring French cliché. You know her. She's la Parisienne, that slightly haughty Frenchie with no body fat who strolls down the Boulevard Saint-Germain looking très chic and who embodies the word sexy like no other. Disclaimer. I use the word sexy throughout this book, well aware that it's among the most overused word on the planet. Hackneyed, blitzed out, postcoital and postmodern, sexy is exhausted by the truly polymorphously perverse weight of its own significance.
We've just heard a sampling of What French Women Know by Deborah Olivier. Well, readers, I'd never heard of this book, but as I researched the top books about love, this was on several lists. Adverbs by Daniel Handler is a novel about love and different people in and out of different kinds of love. At the start, Andrea is in love with David, or maybe it's Joe, who instead falls in love with Peter in a taxi. At the end of the story, it's Joe who's falling in love with Andrea, though it might not be Andrea. And then there's Allison, who's married to Adrian, though considers a fling with Keith and also with Steve. Sounds confusing? Yeah. But that's love. And as the author says, it's not the nouns. The miracle is the adverbs, the way things are done. Oliver Wyman narrates.
She stood on the corner and wiped her eye again, but now she was crying. Somehow, she was crying by the time we reached the same corner and were almost all the way into a cab. I'm going, I said, and shut the door. She stared at me through the window like I was maybe nothing. The cab driver asked me where I wanted to go, and I told him 79th Street, and then I apologized for making him wait like that at the corner, and I told him I would give him an extra couple of bucks or something. Don't worry about it, he said, and looked at me in the rearview mirror, a polite smile. His eyes veered off my reflection and onto the reflection of the traffic behind us, so we could merge. And we merged. And that's when, immediately, I fell in love with my cab driver. I changed my mind, I told him. Then I decided I shouldn't tell him, not yet. His cab number was 6J108. His first name was Peter, I saw, and his last name looked like somebody had just dropped their forearm onto the typewriter keyboard, someplace in Europe, I guess. Penn Station, I have to go somewhere. I felt the weight of the lie I had told Andrea, enormous and undeserved, and vowed I'd never do something like that again. But not telling Peter everything that was in my heart wasn't a lie, right? That was just good timing. That was just being sensitive. I don't have to go somewhere, I said. Not really. But I think I should go somewhere. Okay, he said. It didn't make a difference to him, and I loved him all the more for it. We turned left. You have pretty eyes, I said.
Yeah, Peter said. It's pretty nice, since they cleaned it up.
So you've had surgery, I said. That's okay. Some people think it's vanity, but I don't think it's any more vain than buying a sweater. It's funny we're talking about sweaters because I lost one in a taxi once. It was blue, a nice shade of blue. Andrea and I, that's the girl, Andrea, who kept you waiting because I was breaking up with her, we were first going out. This was maybe 3 years ago. We caught a cab at the very same corner, actually, where I met you, Peter. And we were chatting about this and that on our way to a party, I think a party, and we started kissing and you know how that goes. Peter said. Somebody in front of us had done something. I'm sorry, I said. I don't mean to distract you. To make a long story short, we lost the sweater.
If it's okay, Peter said and pulled up to the curb. To my dismay, we were there already.
I rolled down the window to get a better look. Penn Station swerved to the left, and for a moment I thought there had been another catastrophe, but it was just me swerving to the right. Peter was parking the cab in a rare, empty spot across the street, one kernel of corn sticking in the gap between somebody's teeth.
I gotta have a cup of coffee, Peter explained, so I'm going to stop here, if it's okay.
The clock in his car hadn't adjusted to daylight savings time yet and said it was 4:15 when it was really 5:15. Peter probably didn't have time to fiddle with it, or it was tricky, as car clocks are. I didn't mind. You can't mind these things, you just can't. For to dislike what makes a person human is to dislike all humans, or at least other people who can't work clocks. You have to love the whole person if you are truly in love. If you are going to take a lifelong journey with somebody, you can't mind if the other person believes they are leaving for that journey an hour earlier than you, as long as truly, in the real world, you are both leaving at exactly the same time. He turned to face me, and I saw what I owed him. Here you go, I said, opening my wallet and handing him something. It was risky not to look at the bill, but I wanted him to know that I considered the commercial aspect of our relationship over and done with. Here you go, I said again, because a garbage truck was going by and I couldn't be sure he had heard me the first time. And yes, it's more than okay. I would love to have a cup of coffee with you. Peter was already outside, looking up and down the street and waiting for me to leave the cab and join him. I stepped out and everything looked ugly. Spots of gum on the street and smoke in all the oxygen. They say that when you're really in love, the world becomes gossamer and gorgeous. But in my experience, with Peter and, I suppose, in a more naive time in my life with Andrea and Bob Dylan, the world gets grimy and the love object is in stark relief from the surroundings. This is love, a pretty thing on an ugly street, and why wouldn't you pick it up if it appeared in a cab? Finders keepers is what they say, and I wanted to be kept. I could see, in this stark relief, every inch of Peter's clothing as he nodded politely to me and began to walk toward a grimy little diner place, Sal's. Black jeans, a sort of olive-green jacket with a rip on one of the elbows covered in masking tape. Pretty, pretty, pretty. I won't bore you with the details of Sal's. Peter walked ahead of me to a booth, and after wondering if I dared sit next to him rather than across, I slid into the across seat. Best to give him space. I didn't let the fact that I apparently no longer lived at 37th and What's-It pressure us into moving in together. I knew I could probably find a studio month to month. Ridiculous, maybe, but if you live in New York, real estate decisions can often supersede any other issues in a relationship, and it can be ugly, ugly. Two coffees, I told somebody who worked at Sal's, and they brought them at the exact same time. Peter said. He looked confused. I understand, I said. It's overwhelming, isn't it? I'm sorry, I'll shut up. You talk. Milk?
I don't have a lot of time, Peter said, taking it black.
I made a note for the coffees we'd drink in the future.
I'm sort of on the schedule.
I understand, I said. We can just take it easy. I should probably catch a train at some point, see my dad, tell him what happened.
Okay, Peter said.
But I could tell it wasn't okay. He was looking over my shoulder, making a little jiggling motion with a clasped hand, like he was running a pen through the air. I guess I could say it in a letter, I agreed, if that would help things any. The check came, and I threw another bill on it without looking. But it's really quite simple. Amazing, isn't it, that something like this happens so frequently, yet it boils down to three simple words.
Yeah, okay,
Peter said, and swallowed the rest of his coffee. He was bracing himself, I realized. He thought maybe I would reject him.
That was Adverbs by Daniel Handler.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Saslow is the author of the Wall Street Journal column Moving On. It focuses on life transitions and often attracts wide media interest. Case in point. In September 2007, Saslow attended the final lecture of Carnegie Mellon University professor Randy Pausch. Saslow's column about the talk sparked a worldwide phenomenon. Tens of millions of people have since viewed footage of the lecture. The last lecture, the subsequent book by Pausch with Saslow, was a number one New York Times bestseller, spending more than 110 weeks on the list. Jeff, a Philadelphia native, is a grad of Carnegie Mellon and got his start at the Orlando Sentinel. He moved to the Wall Street Journal for the first time from 1983 to 87. He wrote a front-page feature about a competition to replace Ann Landers at the Chicago Sun-Times. Jeff entered to get an angle for his story and won the job over 12,000 other applicants. He worked as a columnist at the Sun-Times from 1987 to 2001. Jeff's 2009 book about female friendship, The Girls from Ames, spent 26 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Also in 2009, Jeff co-authored Highest Duty, the memoir of Captain Sully Sullenberger, who famously landed the U.S. Airways Flight 1549 in the Hudson River. Who could forget that image? Highest Duty debuted at number 3 on the New York Times list. In 2011, Jeff collaborated with Representative Gabrielle Giffords and her husband, veteran astronaut Mark Kelly, on their memoir, Gabby, A Story of Courage and Hope. We actually previewed that book on December 25th. Jeff's latest book, The Magic Room, A Story About the Love We Wish for Our Daughters, has just been published. It's a nonfiction narrative set in a small-town Michigan bridal shop. The book looks at the lives of a handful of brides and their parents who've journeyed to the store's magic room. Welcome, Jeff. Thanks for joining us today on the Book Report.
Oh, thanks, Lane, for having me.
The Magic Room is a book about love, but from a very unique perspective. How did you decide to construct the book around a bridal shop?
Well, I have three daughters. They're 22, 20, and 16. And I wanted to write a book about the love we all wish for our daughters. And I thought, well, you know, I write nonfiction. Where could I set such a book? And I thought maybe maternity wards or daddy-daughter dances. I was trying to figure it out. And my wife said there's something about a wedding dress. And so I thought, well, maybe a bridal shop. And so I found this bridal shop in the middle of central Michigan. It's a little tiny town. It's in an old bank building that went under during the Depression. It's been in the same family since 1934. And it's in an old bank building. And the vault where the money used to be, that's where they put mirrors, and that's where the brides crown the dress they think is the one. And 100,000 brides have walked into that room since 1934. And so I wrote a book called The Magic Room, which is what they call the room. The Magic Room, a story about the love we wish for our daughters.
Hmm. I love that you describe the town as having 1,100 residents and 2,500 wedding dresses.
Yeah, it might be more wedding dresses per capita than anywhere in the world.
And actually, how did you find out about Becker's?
Well, I live in near Detroit, so I wanted to find a bridal shop close to my home. It turns out it's 100 miles exactly from my house. I just started looking at bridal shops in Michigan, and as soon as I found Becker's Bridal, I knew I'd found the one.
Well, a fact in your book is that since 1934, as you said, the store served more than 100,000 brides. So how do the brides know to come there?
You know, it's sort of like the best-kept secret. Even in Detroit, brides don't usually travel out there because it's 100 miles away. But some families, you know, the great-grandmother bought her dress there, the grandmother, the mother, and they just find it. You know, it's truly out in the middle of nowhere. It's like everybody that walks into the store, they have to use the bathroom when they get there.
How much time did you spend on site researching the book?
I spent the last year going back and forth there, and I picked 8 brides, and I followed their lives from the moment they stepped on the Magic Room pedestal until their weddings. And in doing so, I was able to tell the stories of their lives leading up to coming into the store and about their families. And then I tied in the story of the Becker family and how they went through the years in the bridal shop. And, you know, what we learned about the culture of bridal gowns in the last 75 years. And the hope was that as people read it, they'll think about their own daughters and their own lives.
We know, I loved one of your paragraphs. It was about Shelley, the current proprietress of the shop, and her feeling that mirrors are a reflection of the past and that our spirits remain in the mirrors with everybody else's. So when a bride looks in at the store's old mirror, she's connected to every bride who came before her. I thought that was so poignant.
Yeah, beautiful. And, you know, as I said in the book, you know, if you go to Monticello, where Thomas Jefferson lived, he looked in that mirror that you look in when you go to his room at Monticello. So the same is true for these brides. You know, a lot of happy marriages happened in that store, resulted from the weddings that began in that store, and then, you know, some brides didn't make it to the finish line. But they're all connected.
Yeah. Can you share one of your favorite bride stories?
Well, you know, I didn't want to write, like, the Bridezilla stories and Say Yes to the Dress. I mean, those shows are fun, but I really wanted to think about the brides were taking it seriously, the idea of getting married, and the families that didn't necessarily have an easy way to get to the store emotionally, or they some had tragedies in their lives. You know, one bride that I profile in the book, she tried on her dress, left the next day, and got in a pretty terrible car accident. She lost the fingers on her right hand in the car accident, but her fiancé stood by her, and she ends up getting married on time, and so that's a pretty touching story. I got another bride who's 40 years old. She said she had a million man march until she found the right guy. And so we didn't write about all 1 million men, but we came close. And then there's a third bride. She, like her three sisters, she made a vow not to even kiss her husband until they got married. So, you know, it's a sort of religious family. I have an atheist in the book. I have a very religious family. We try to have a little a mix.
Mm. Well, did you see any bridezillas in Fowler, Michigan?
I did, of course. Yeah, it's tough. You know, but I don't. That's not the book I wanted to write. I mean, it's a little bit of that in the book. You know, at Becker's, the salespeople, they know, they can sort of tell how a marriage is going to make it by how a mother and daughter interact. If the daughter's going to be with her mother, what is she going to be like with her husband? And in fact, over the years, they had their own language in the store. In the old days, they liked the bride, they would call her girly, like, oh, girly, you look so beautiful in that dress. And if they thought she was being a jerk, the bride, they would say, one coworker would say to another, will you help this sweetheart get into the dress? Sweetheart was code for this one's trouble.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about the family. I mean, Shelley seems like an amazing person, but there's big history there. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, the bridal shop was started by Eva Becker. She was a tough businesswoman in the 1930s, and she ran with a tough hand. She wasn't, you know, all sweet with the bride. She just looked interested in selling dresses, and then it was passed on to her son and daughter-in-law, and then to Shelley. And Shelley's daughter, who's 22 now works in the store. And, you know, it used to be a bride would come in, and in an hour she'd have her dress, 45 minutes, and that would be it. Now it's a big, long process. Brides go to different stores. They'll go for weeks trying on dresses. You know, they might try on 50 dresses at Becker's and then buy the dress for $50 cheaper on the internet. So it's a different world today in a lot of respects.
Mm. Well, one thing about the book, you had an amazing amount of facts about marriage. For example, I was shocked to learn that 25% of the first-time brides have children.
Yeah, nowadays, 7% are pregnant.
And more than 40% of children born in the U.S. each day are the offspring of an unmarried woman. I mean, wow, I never thought about that or kind of thought it was that high.
Yeah, and also, 39% of Americans today, according to a Pew Research poll last year, feel that marriage is becoming obsolete. But a bridal gown is really about hope. You know, it's about the hope for the future. It's about a hope for love. And I was trying to look at at the possibilities in marriage and about what parents wish for their, you know, their young adult daughters.
It's a wonderfully sweet and poignant book with lots and lots of interesting statistics. So what's your next project? Are you even thinking about that yet?
You know, I've just written 5 books in 4 years. I just finished another book with Gabby Gifford, you know, the congresswoman and her husband.
Yes.
So that book took a lot out of me. That was actually written before The Magic Room, after The Magic Room, but it came out before.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to take a break for a while.
Your book was wonderful. I so enjoyed reading it. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Book Report.
Hey, thank you, Elaine, for having me.
All right, bye. And now, let's listen to a sampling of The Magic Room, a story about the love we wish for our daughters, narrated by Sandra Burr and Jeffrey Zaslow.
As for The Magic Room, the saleswomen at Becker's don't use the word magic lightly when talking about it. They routinely watch brides and their mothers melt into tears in this room as they reflect on all the moments in their lives that led them here. After seeing their daughters on that pedestal, fathers are often overcome with emotion too. They excuse themselves, leaving the vault and then the store, so they can compose themselves. Fathers can be seen pacing up and down Main Street in Fowler, blowing their noses and wiping their eyes. We live in an age when TV reality shows, Say Yes to the Dress, Bridezillas, have drawn attention by showcasing the frenzied pursuit of the wedding dress. These programs are framed like sporting events, with brides bickering and dickering and racing toward a finish line marked by their selection of a dress. Some of this goes on at Becker's too, of course, but I came here not just to write about wedding gowns and what they represent. I also wanted to understand the women wearing them, their fears and yearnings. I resolved to pay less attention to brides I met whose motives seemed somewhat frivolous, the ones more focused on their dresses than their upcoming marriages. Instead, I wanted to find brides and their families whose paths here were not necessarily easy, but who have given great thought to the love that guides and connects them. I guess I wanted to stand in the magic room with these families whose stories touched me the most, and while there, contemplate my feelings for my own daughters. For a decade now, I have written a column for the Wall Street Journal about our most emotional life transitions. That's my beat. Before this job, I spent 14 years as an advice columnist. In 1987, I won a competition to replace Ann Landers at the Chicago Sun-Times. And so I long have been drawn to stories about love, especially the bonds between parents and daughters. My three daughters are now ages 21, 19, and 15, and I know they will need love in their lives, from me, my wife, each other, and someday, I hope, from their husbands and children. As my girls have grown up, I've always tried to pay attention to the detailed ways in which other parents express affection for their daughters, the ways they sought to reassure or encourage them. As a father, I was often guided by the readers of my columns and the thousands of letters they sent my way. Their stories remain with me and have helped me find my bearings in the magic room. There was the judge in Illinois who told me he grew up in a home where everyone always said, "I love you." Because of that, he found it easy to say those words to his own children. One Friday night in 1995, as his 18-year-old daughter headed out the door with her friends, he said to her, "Remember, I love you." She replied, "I love you too, Dad." She died hours later in a car accident, and the judge told me how grateful he was that his last words to her were a reminder of his love. The judge's wife wasn't raised in a family where affection was articulated so effortlessly, and so the words didn't come as easily to her. She was in the other room that day and wasn't fated to have a final loving exchange with her daughter. She told me she didn't need to say, "I love you." Her daughter knew she was loved. And yet a part of her ached because she wishes she had said it. Again and again, people have explained to me the ways in which "I love you" can be said to daughters without saying it. A woman once wrote to me to explain that when she was growing up, her mother never asked her to wash dishes. Even if she offered to help, her mother wouldn't let her near the sink. "As long as I live," her mother told her, "I want to do this. After I'm gone, many dishes will be left for you, and I hope it warms your heart to remember that I always did them for you." Since her mother's death, this woman often thinks of her, happily, when she washes dishes. "She was setting this up," the woman told me. "She wasn't always in good health, and she knew the time would come." I've seen how people's love for their daughters can be strengthened in times of adversity. I was moved by conversations I had with an 81-year-old reader whose 60-year-old daughter had Alzheimer's. She spoke of changing her daughter's diaper, just as she had 60 years earlier. "When I push her in her wheelchair, I think of how I pushed her in her baby buggy," she said. This mother had always assumed that when she got old, her daughter would lovingly look after her.
We've just heard The Magic Room by Jeffrey Zaslow.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
What is love? Great minds have been grappling with this question through the ages, and in our era, they have come up with many different answers. According to Western philosopher Pat Benatar, love is a battlefield. Frank Sinatra would add the corollary that love is a tender trap. Love hurts, love stinks, love bites, love bleeds. Love is the drug. The troubadours of our times agree that they want to know what love is, and they want you to show them. But the answer is simple, according to author Rob Sheffield. Love is a mixtape, life and love, one song at a time. In the 90s, when alternative was mainstream, bands like Pearl Jam and Nirvana were all the rage on MTV. It was also when a shy music geek named Rob Sheffield met Renee, a hell-raising Appalachian punk rocker. She was way too cool for him, but they fell in love. They had nothing in common, except they both loved music. Music brought them together and kept them together. And it was music that would help Rob through a sudden, unfathomable loss. In Love is a Mixtape, Rob, a writer for Rolling Stone, uses the songs on 15 mixtapes to tell the story of his brief time with Renee. From Elvis to the Rolling Stones, the songs on these tapes make up the soundtrack to their lives. This is Rob's tribute to music, to the decade that shaped him, to love, but most of all, to one unforgettable woman. The book is performed by the author.
Some nights you go to the mall with your squeeze, you're both a little wasted, and you come home with the Jenny Garth workout video. That's probably buried in one of these boxes, too. Neither of us ever threw anything away. We made a lot of mixtapes while we were together. Tapes for making out, tapes for dancing, tapes for falling asleep, tapes for doing the dishes, for walking the dog. I kept them all. I have them piled up on my bookshelves, spilling out of my kitchen cabinets, scattered all over the bedroom floor. I didn't even have pots or pans in my kitchen, just that old boombox on the counter next to the sink. So many tapes. I met Renee in Charlottesville, Virginia, when we were both 23. When the bartender at the Eastern Standard put on a tape, Big Stars Radio City, she was the only other person in the room who perked up. So we drank bourbon and talked about music. We traded stories about the bands we liked, shows we'd seen. Renee loved the Replacements and Alex Chilton and the Meat Puppets. So did I. I loved the Smiths. Renee hated the Smiths. The second song on the tape is Cemetery Gates by the Smiths. The first night we met, I told her the same thing I've told every single girl I've ever had a crush on. I'll make you a tape. Except this time, with this girl, it worked. When we were planning our wedding a year later, she said that instead of stepping on a glass at the end of the ceremony, she wanted to step on a cassette case, since that's what she'd been doing ever since she met me. Falling in love with Renee was not the kind of thing you walk away from in one piece. I had no chance. She put a hitch in my get-along. She would wake up in the middle of the night and say things like, "What if Bad Bad Leroy Brown was a girl?" Or, "Why don't they have commercials for salt like they do for milk?" Then she would fall back to sleep, while I would lie awake and give thanks for this alien creature beside whom I rested. Renee was a real cool, hell-raising Appalachian punk rock girl. Her favorite song was the Rolling Stones' Let's Spend the Night Together. Her favorite album was Pavement's Slanted and Enchanted. She rooted for the Atlanta Braves and sewed her own silver vinyl pants. She knew which kind of screwdriver was which. She baked pies, but not very often. She could rap Roxanne Shanté's Go On Girl all the way through. She called Eudora Welty Miss Eudora. She had an MFA in fiction and never got any stories published, but she kept writing them anyway. She bought too many shoes and dyed her hair red. Her voice was full of the frazzle and crackle of music. Renee was a country girl, 3 months older than me. She was born on November 21st, 1965, the same day as Bjork, in the Metropolitan Mobile Home Park in North Cross, Georgia. She grew up in Southwest Virginia with her parents, Buddy and Nadine, and her little sister. When she was three, Buddy was transferred to the defense plant in Pulaski County, so her folks spent a summer building a house there. Renee used to sit in the backyard, feeding grass to the horses next door through the fence. She had glasses, curly brown hair, and a beagle named Snoopy. She went to Fairlawn Baptist Church and Pulaski High School and Hollins College. She got full immersion baptized in Clater Lake. The first record she ever owned was KC and the Sunshine Band's Get Down Tonight. KC was her first love. I was her last. I was a shy, skinny Irish Catholic geek from Boston. I'd never met anybody like Renee before. I moved to Charlottesville for grad school, my plans all set. Go down south, get my degree, then haul ass to the next town. The South was a scary new world. The first time I saw a possum in my driveway, I shook a bony fist at the sky and cursed this godforsaken rustic hole. I'm 23. Life is passing me by. My ancestors spent centuries in the hills of County Kerry, waist deep in sheep, getting shot at by English soldiers. And my grandparents crossed the ocean in coffin ships to come to America just so I could get possum rabies. Renee had never set foot north of Washington, D.C. For her, Charlottesville was the big bad city. She couldn't believe her eyes just because there were sidewalks everywhere. Her ancestors were Appalachians from the hills of West Virginia. Both of her grandfathers were coal miners. We had nothing in common, except we both loved music. It was the first connection we had, and we depended on it to keep us together.
That was Love is a Mixtape by Rob Sheffield.
Have a new iPad, Nook, or e-reader, new television, laptop, iPod, or appliance? If you've been worrying if your new gadgets will still work next year, then you need Warranty of America. For just $9.95 each month, you get a 4-year extended warranty on everything you bought last holiday season, plus everything else you buy for the rest of your life. That's right, just $9.95 per month covers your entire household. It covers an unlimited number of electronics, appliances, and computers. If it plugs in, we protect it. All for just $9.95 per month. Coverage has no deductibles, no additional fees. If they can't fix it or replace it, you'll get your purchase price back. No contract. You can cancel anytime. Order now. Call 877-746-4692 or enter radio with the promotional code at warrantyofamerica.com. You'll get 1 month free, so call 877-746-4692 for Warranty of America. It'll be the last warranty you'll ever need.
Another book from the top books about love, and another one I'd never heard of, is Indu Sundari Sen's heart-wrenching tale of love and clashing cultures in World War II India. In The Splendor of Silence, Sam Hawthorne, a young U.S. Army captain, arrives in a tiny princely state in western India. The year is 1942. He carries combat wounds and several secrets, one of which is the real reason behind his visit. It's to find his brother Mike, an American soldier who disappeared after joining the local struggle for independence. But Sam's mission is soon threatened when he falls in love with Mila, daughter of a political agent. Betrothed to the local prince, Mila draws Sam into a doomed affair that places them both in the paths of dynastic intrigue, racial prejudice, and the explosive circumstances of a country torn between imperialism and nationalism. Sneha Mathan narrates.
On other nights, they would build a fire on the beach, huddling together in a blanket, while Sam told her stories, and Olivia would fall asleep, warm in his arms, not awakening until morning in her own bed. Sam's stories were mostly of India. Rajas atop caparisoned elephants, camel markets in the desert, bazaars in a riot of colors, the chug of a train journey, the fire of curry in his belly. Every now and then, very late at night when it was quiet, and the rains came to scatter mellow gold drops in the light on the cabin's deck, he would be reminded of his first trip into Burma in April 1942 and into the thick of the war. And those were stories of packed, impenetrable jungles, stone pagodas, the slick of sweat, the crackle of gunfire, the pain of death. By the time she reaches the cabin, the rain has begun again. The skies have turned a mottled gray. A muted thunder rumbles over the Cascade Mountains, over the bejeweled city of Seattle, and disperses into this sheltered cove in the Puget Sound. Olivia lights the fire in the stove, removes her coat, and rubs her cold hands together. Then she drags the enormous mahogany leather trunk from the front door to the rug in front of the stove. The knuckled brass fittings on the trunk gleam gently in the light from the fire as Olivia lifts the lid. The trunk arrived 5 days ago from India. A 21st birthday gift for her, from whom she is yet to discover. On the same day this trunk came, her father died, so she now has to discover its secrets for herself. She tugs at the silks at the very top, and the fragrance of jasmine and smoke eddies around, let loose from its imprisonment within the trunk. The materials melt under her hand, the colors as vivid today as they must have been when they were woven. The pale lilac of early lavender, the pink of roses heavy with fragrance, the yellow of near-ripe mangoes. Olivia hugs the cool silks to her chest, wondering how anyone could drape these long lengths of cloth around themselves and still manage to look elegant, as her mother must have once. The only aromas from the fabrics are of mothballs and sandalwood. There is no hint of the real, living woman who once wore these saris, whom her father loved so much, whom Sam continued to love, but whom he could never talk about, not even to their child, not even to Olivia. She reaches in. An enamel-etched casket holds tiny silver anklets, blackened with age, their bells tinkling like faintly heard wind chimes. A black cord is coiled inside a palm-sized wooden box inlaid with old ivory. It is too thick to be broken by hand and is hung with little gold charms, a few golden beads, a coin with a dog carved on it, and a minute gold cylinder, scarcely larger than Olivia's fingernail. She strings the cord with its frayed edges around her throat and it barely fits, so it is not a necklace. Then what? There are photographs in a transparent envelope. Letters. A wooden doll. Three carved wooden monkeys that fit in the palm of her hand. Olivia takes out one of the photographs and gazes at the woman in it. She has a thick swath of hair, sharp collarbones, a gentle face, a sweet smile. Who is she? Is she... She looks again at the photograph, yearning to see something in the woman's face that she, Olivia, also carries in her own face. But there is little resemblance, for the woman's face is thin and long, and Olivia's is broad, rounded. They both have long hair, black as thunderclouds, though that is too little of a coincidence to claim as ancestry. The woman's skin is smooth, as though things have not yet happened to her in her life. She half smiles, and yet a little edge of discontent seems to lift the edge of her mouth. There are no colors, but black and shades of gray, so no way to tell the color of her blouse or the sari pallu that drapes over the woman's left shoulder. Her neck is bare. Tiny gold studs glow in her ears, and there is a flash of what looks like a diamond in her nose.
That was The Splendor of Silence by Indu Sundarasan. Hidden somewhere in nearly every major city in the world is an underground seduction lair. And in these lairs, men trade the most devastatingly effective techniques ever invented to charm women. This is not fiction. These men exist. They gather in houses known as projects, and best-selling author Neil Strauss spent 2 years living among them. The result is The Game, penetrating the secret society of pickup artists, a controversial book for sure, that may transform the way women understand the opposite sex. On his journey from AFC, Average Frustrated Chump, to PUA, Pickup Artist, to PUG, Pickup Guru, Strauss not only shares scores of original seduction techniques, but also has unforgettable encounters with the likes of Tom Cruise, Britney Spears, Paris Hilton, and Courtney Love. And then things really start to get strange, and passions lead to betrayals. The author narrates...
The only other item of clothing on his trembling body was a winter cap pulled tight over his skull. It was June in Los Angeles. This living thing. He was speaking again. It's so pointless. He turned and looked at me through wet red eyes. It's tic-tac-toe. There's no way you can win. So the best thing to do is not to play it. There was no one else in the house. I would have to deal with this. He needed to be sedated before he snapped out of tears and back into anger. Each cycle of emotions grew worse. And this time I was afraid he'd do something that couldn't be undone. I couldn't let mystery die on my watch. He was more than just a friend. He was a mentor. He changed my life, as he had the lives of thousands of others just like me. I needed to get him Valium, Xanax, Vicodin, anything. I grabbed my phone book and scanned the pages for people most likely to have pills. People like guys in rock bands, women who just had plastic surgery, former child actors. But everyone I called wasn't home, didn't have any drugs, or claimed not to have any drugs because they didn't want to share. There was only one person left to call, the woman who had triggered Mystery's downward spiral. She was a party girl. She must have something. Katya, a petite Russian blonde with a Smurfette voice and the energy of a Pomeranian puppy, was at the front door in 10 minutes with a Xanax and a worried look on her face. "Don't come in," I warned her. "He'll probably kill you." Not that she didn't entirely deserve it, of course. Or so I thought at the time. I gave Mystery the pill and a glass of water and waited until the sobs slowed to a sniffle. Then I helped him into a pair of black boots, jeans, and a gray t-shirt. He was docile now, like a big baby. I walked him outside to my old Corvette and stuffed him into the tiny front seat. Every now and then, I'd see a tremor of anger flash across his face or a tear roll out of his eyes. I hoped he'd remain calm long enough for me to help him. "I want to learn martial arts," he said docilely. "So when I want to kill someone, I can do something about it." I stepped on the accelerator. Our destination was the Hollywood Mental Health Center on Vine Street. It was an ugly slab of concrete surrounded day and night by homeless men who screamed at lampposts, transvestites who lived out of shopping carts, and other remaindered human beings who set up camp where free social services could be found. Mystery, I realized, was one of them. He just happened to have charisma and talent, which drew others to him and prevented him from ever being left alone in the world. He possessed two traits I noticed in nearly every rock star I've ever interviewed: a crazy driven gleam in his eyes and an absolute inability to do anything for himself. I brought him into the lobby, signed him in, and together we waited for a turn with one of the counselors. He sat in a cheap plastic black chair, staring catatonically at the institutional blue walls. An hour passed. He began to fidget. 2 hours passed. His brow furrowed, his face clouded. 3 hours passed. The tears started. 4 hours passed. He bolted out of his chair and ran out of the waiting room and through the front door of the building. He walked briskly, like a man who knew where he was going, although Project Hollywood was 3 miles away. I chased him across the street and caught up to him outside a mini mall. I took his arm and turned him around, baby-talking him back into the waiting room. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30. He was up and out again. I ran after him. Two social workers stood uselessly in the lobby. "Stop him," I yelled. "We can't," one of them said. "He's left the premises." "So you're just going to let a suicidal man walk out of here?" I couldn't waste time arguing. "Just have a therapist ready to see him if I get him back here." I ran out the door and looked to my right. He wasn't there. I looked left. Nothing. I ran north to Fountain Street, spotted him around the corner, and dragged him back again. When we arrived, the social workers led him down a long hallway and into a claustrophobic cubicle with a sheet vinyl floor. The therapist sat behind a desk, running a finger through a black tangle in her hair. She was a slim Asian woman in her late 20s, with high cheekbones, dark red lipstick, and a pinstriped pantsuit. Mystery slumped in a chair across from her. "So how are you feeling today?" she asked, forcing a smile. "I'm feeling," Mystery said, "like there's no point to anything." He burst into tears. "I'm listening," she said, scrawling a note on her pad. The case was probably already closed for her. "So, I'm removing myself from the gene pool," he sobbed. She looked at him with feigned sympathy as he continued. To her, he was just one of a dozen nut jobs she saw a day. All she needed to figure out was whether he required medication or institutionalization.
We've just heard The Game by Neil Strauss. Readers, it's been my pleasure to offer up some literary gifts for your Valentine's Day. For more tempting titles, check out my website, bookreportradio.com. I'm hoping your day is filled with hearts, flowers, of course, chocolates, and many special moments. See you back here next week on The Book Report.